Nora, from within, taking off my fancy dress. Helmer, yes, do, try and calm yourself and make your mind easy again, my frightened little singing bird. Nora enters in everyday dress. I have changed my things now. Helmer, but what for? So late as this? Nora, it is for the reason that I cannot remain with you any longer. Helmer, Nora, Nora, you are out of your mind. I won't allow it. I forbid you. Nora, it is no use to forbid me anything any longer. Helmer, you do not love me anymore. Nora, no. Helmer, Nora, and you can say that? Nora, it gives me great pain, but I cannot help it. Helmer, I see, an abyss has opened between us. There is no denying it. But Nora, would it not be possible to fill it up? Nora, as I am now, I am no wife for you. She takes cloak and hat in a small bag. Helmer, Nora, not now, wait till tomorrow. Nora, putting on her cloak, I cannot spend the night in a strange man's room. Helmer, all over? All over? Nora, shall you never think of me again? Nora, I know I shall often think of you and the children and this house. Goodbye. She goes out through the hall. Helmer sinks down on a chair at the door and buries his face in his hands. Nora, Nora, looks round and rises. Empty. She's gone. The sound of a door shutting is heard from below. The end. What we have here is a hybrid conflict of the worst kind. It's not static, nor is it always jumping. It's a combination of jumping and rising conflict which might easily confuse the young author. Therefore, we shall examine it more closely. There is rising conflict when Nora announces that she will leave. Helmer forbids her, but she goes just the same. This is all right. But there's jumping conflict elsewhere. The first jump is Nora's reaction to Helmer's forgiveness. She thanks him and leaves the room, leaping over an abyss to do so. Does she really mean that she's grateful, or is she being subtly sarcastic? Nora is not much good at sarcasm. She's acutely aware of the injustice done to her and therefore would not be likely to joke about it, bitterly or otherwise. Yet it doesn't seem like a moment for gratitude on her part. We're left wondering when she leaves the room. When she returns and announces that she cannot remain with Helmer any longer, it is far too sudden. There has been no preparation for such a step. But the greatest jump is Helmer's reaction to the fact that Nora no longer loves him. I see, an abyss has opened between us. It's almost unbelievable that a man of Helmer's character would arrive at such understanding without presenting a powerful rebuttal beforehand. If you'll read the original version at the end of this chapter, you'll see what we mean. Nora leaves at the end of the scene in our version, but it is no decision of her problem. It is a jump, an impulse. We feel no absolute necessity for her action. Perhaps it is a caprice which she will regret and retract tomorrow. Leaving Helmer as she does in our version again, Nora fails to convince us regardless of her justification. This is the inevitable result of a jumping conflict. Whenever a conflict lags, rises jerkily, stops, or jumps, look to your premise. Is it clear-cut? Is it active? Remedy any fault here, and then turn to your characters. Perhaps your protagonist is too weak to carry the burden of the play, bad orchestration. Perhaps some of your characters are not growing constantly. Don't forget that staticness is the direct result of a static character who cannot make up his mind. And don't forget that he may be static because he's not tridimensional. The genuine rising conflict is the product of characters who are well-rounded in terms of the premise. Every action of such a character will be understandable and dramatic to the audience. If your premise is jealousy not only destroys itself but destroys the object of its love, you know or should know that every line of your play, every move your characters make, must further the premise. Granted that there are many solutions for any given situation, your characters are permitted to choose only those which will help prove the premise. The moment you decide upon a premise, you and your characters become its slave. Each character must feel intensely that the action dictated by the premise is the only action possible. Moreover, the dramatist must be convinced of the absolute truth of his premise, or his characters will be the pale repetition of his undigested, superficial conviction. Remember, a play is not an imitation of life, but the essence of life. You must condense all that's important, all that's necessary. You'll see in the last part of A Doll's House how every possibility is exhausted before Nora leaves her husband. Even if you disagree with her final decision, you understand it. For Nora, it's absolutely necessary that she leave. When characters go round and round without making any decision, the play will undoubtedly be a bore, but if they're in a process of growth, there's nothing to fear. The pivotal character is responsible for the growth through conflict. Be sure that your pivotal character is relentless, cannot and will not compromise. Hamlet, Krogstad, Lavinia, Hedda Gabler, Macbeth, Iago, Manders in Ghosts, the Doctors in Yellowjack, these are such pivotal forces that compromise is out of the question. If your play jumps or becomes static, see to it that the unity of opposites is solidly established. The point is that the bond between the characters cannot be broken except through the transformation of a trait or a characteristic in a person or by death itself. But let's go back to Nora once more. Step by step, Nora approached a minor climax. She builds on top of it, arriving at another climax, this time on a higher plane. She goes still higher, constantly fighting, clearing the way until she reaches the ultimate goal, which was contained in the premise. And now, perhaps, you should read the original for yourself. The sentences, italicized, disregarding stage directions, of course, are those we used in our example of jumping conflict. A Doll's House, Act 3. Maid, half-dressed, comes to the door. A letter for the mistress? Helmer, give it to me. Takes the letter and shuts the door. Yes, it is from him. You shall not have it. I will read it myself. Nora, yes, read it. Helmer, standing by the lamp. I scarcely have the courage to do it. It may mean ruin for both of us. No, I must know. Tears open the letter, runs his eye over a few lines, looks at a paper enclosed, and gives a shout of joy. Nora! She looks at him questioningly. Nora! No, I must read it once again. Yes, it is true. I am saved. Nora, I am saved. Nora. And I? Helmer. You too, of course. We are both saved, both you and I. Look, he lends you your bond back. He says he regrets and repents that a happy change in his life, never mind what he says. We're saved, Nora. No one can do anything to you. Oh, Nora, Nora. No, first I must destroy these hateful things. Takes a look at the bond. No, no, I won't look at it. The whole thing shall be nothing but a bad dream to me. Tears up the bond and both letters, throws them all into the stove and watches them burn. There, now it doesn't exist any longer. He says that since Christmas Eve, you... These must have been three dreadful days for you, Nora. Nora, I have fought a hard fight these 3 days. Helmer, and suffered agonies and seen no way out. But no, we won't call any of those horrors to mind. We will only shout with joy and keep saying, it's all over, it's all over. Listen to me, Nora. You don't seem to realize that it's all over. What is this, such a cold, set face? My poor little Nora, I quite understand. You don't feel as if you could believe that I have forgiven you. But it is true, Nora, I swear it. I have forgiven you everything. I know that what you did out of love for me. Nora, that is true. Helmer, you have loved me as a wife ought to love her husband. Only you had not sufficient knowledge to judge by the means you used. But do you suppose you are any the less dear to me because you don't understand how to act on your own responsibility? No, no, only lean on me. I will advise you and direct you. I should not be a man if this womanly helplessness did not just give you a double attractiveness in my eyes. You must not think any more about the hard things I said in my first moment of consternation when I thought everything was going to overwhelm me. I have forgiven you, Nora. I swear to you that I have forgiven you. Nora, thank you for your forgiveness. She goes out through the door to the right. Helmer, no, don't go. Looks in. What are you doing in there? Nora, from within, taking off my fancy dress. Helmer, standing at the open door. Yes, do. Try and calm yourself and make your mind easy again, my frightened little singing bird. Be at rest and feel secure. I have broad wings to shelter you under. Walks up and down by the door. How warm and cozy our home is, Nora. Here is the shelter for you. Here I will protect you like a hunted dove that I have saved from a hawk's claws. I will bring peace to your poor beating heart. It will come little by little, Nora, believe me. Tomorrow morning you will look upon it all quite differently. Soon everything will be just as it was before. Very soon you won't need me to assure you that I have forgiven you. you will yourself feel the certainty that I have done so. Can you suppose I should ever think of such a thing as repudiating you or even reproaching you? You have no idea what a true man's heart is like, Nora. There is something so indescribably sweet and satisfying to a man in the knowledge that he has forgiven his wife, forgiven her freely and with all his heart. It seems as if that had made her, as it were, doubly his own. He has given her a new life, so to speak, and she has, in a way, become both wife and child to him. So you shall be for me after this, my little scared, helpless darling. Have no anxiety about anything. Nora, only be frank and open with me, and I will serve as will and conscience both to you. What is this? Not gone to bed? Have you changed your things? Nora, in everyday dress. Yes, Torvald, I have changed my things now. Helmer, but what for? So late as this? Nora, I shall not sleep tonight. Helmer, but my dear Nora. Nora, looking at her watch. It is not so very late. Sit down here, Torvald. You and I have much to say to one another. She sits down at one side of the table. Helmer, Nora, what is this? This cold, set face? Nora, sit down. It will take some time. I have a lot to talk over with you. Helmer, down at the opposite side of the table. You alarm me, Nora, and I don't understand you. Nora, no, that is just it. You don't understand me, and I have never understood you either, before tonight. No, you mustn't interrupt me. You must simply listen to what I say. Torvald, this is a settling of accounts. Helmer, what do you mean by that? Nora, after a short silence, isn't there one thing that strikes you as strange in our sitting here like this? Helmer, what is that? Nora, we have been married now 8 years. Does it not occur to you that this is the first time we two, you and I, husband and wife, have had a serious conversation? Helmer, what do you mean by serious? Nora, in all these 8 years, longer than that, from the very beginning of our acquaintance, we have never exchanged a word on any serious subject. Helmer, was it likely that I would be continually and forever telling you about worries that you could not help me to bear? Nora, I'm not speaking about business matters. I say that we have never sat down in earnest together to try and get at the bottom of anything. Helmer, but, dearest Nora, would it have been any good to you? Nora, that's just it. You have never understood me. I have been greatly wrong, Torvald, first by Papa and then by you. Helmer, what? By us two? By us two, who have loved you better than anyone else in the world? Nora, shaking her head, you have never loved me. You have only thought it pleasant to be in love with me. Helmer, Nora, what do I hear you saying? Nora, it is perfectly true, Torvald. When I was at home with Papa, he told me his opinion about everything, and so I had the same opinions, and if I differed from him, I concealed the fact, because he would not have liked it. He called me his doll child, and he played with me just as I used to play with my dolls. And when I came to live with you? Helmer, what sort of an expression is that to use about our marriage? Nora, undisturbed, I mean that I was simply transferred from Papa's hands into yours. You arranged everything according to your own taste, and so I got the same tastes as you, or else I pretended to. I am really not quite sure which. I think sometimes the one and sometimes the other. When I look back on it, it seems to me as if I had been living here like a poor woman, just from hand to mouth. I have existed merely to perform tricks for you, Torvald, but you would have it so. You and Papa have committed a great sin against me. It is your fault that I have made nothing of my life. Helmer, how unreasonable and how ungrateful you are, Nora. Have you not been happy here? Nora, no, I have never been happy. I thought I was, but it has never really been so. Helmer, not happy? Nora, no, only merry. And you have always been so kind to me. But our home has been nothing but a playroom. I have been your doll wife, just as at home I was Papa's doll child, and here the children have been my dolls. I thought it great fun when you played with me, just as they thought it great fun when I played with them. That is what our marriage has been, Torvald. Helmer, there is some truth in what you say, exaggerated and strained as your view of it is. But for the future it will be different. Playtime shall be over, and lesson time shall begin. Nora, whose lessons? Mine or the children's? Helmer, both yours and the children's, my darling Nora. Nora, alas, Torvald, you are not the man to educate me into being a proper wife for you. Helmer, and you can say that? Nora, and I. How am I fitted to bring up the children? Nora. Helmer. Nora! Nora. Didn't you say so yourself a little while ago that you dare not trust me to bring them up? Helmer. In a moment of anger. Why do you pay any heed to that? Nora. Indeed, you were perfectly right. I am not fit for the task. There is another task I must undertake first. I must try and educate myself. You are not the man to help me in that. I must do that for myself, and that is why I'm going to leave you now. Helmer, springing up, what do you say? Nora, I must stand quite alone if I am to understand myself and everything about me. It is for that reason that I cannot remain with you any longer. Helmer, Nora, Nora! Nora, I am going away from here now at once. I am sure Christine will take me in for the night. Helmer, you are out of your mind. I won't allow it. I forbid you. Nora, it is no use forbidding me anything any longer. I will take with me what belongs to myself. I will take nothing from you, either now or later. Helmer, what sort of madness is this? Nora, tomorrow I shall go home. I mean to my old home. It will be easiest for me to find something to do there. Helmer, you blind, foolish woman! Nora, I must try and get some sense, Torvald. Helmer, to desert your home, your husband, and your children? And you don't consider what people will say? Nora, I cannot consider that at all. I only know that it's necessary for me. Helmer, it's shocking. This is how you would neglect your most sacred duties? Nora, what do you consider my most sacred duties? Helmer, do I need to tell you that? Are they not your duties to your husband and your children? Nora, I have other duties just as sacred. Helmer, that you have not. What duties could those be? Nora, duties to myself. Helmer, before all else, you are a wife and a mother. Nora, I don't believe that any longer. I believe that before all else, I am a reasonable human being, just as you are, or at all events, that I must try and become one. I know quite well, Torvald, that most people would think you right, and that views of that kind are to be found in books, but I can no longer content myself with what most people say, or what is found in books. I must think over things for myself and get to understand them. Helmer, can you not understand your place in your own home? Have you not a reliable guide in such matters as that? Have you no religion? Nora, I am afraid, Torvald, I don't exactly know what religion is. Helmer, what are you saying? Nora, I know nothing but what the clergyman said when I went to be confirmed. He told me that religion was this and that and the other. When I am away from all this and am alone, I will look into that matter too. I will see if what the clergyman said is true, or at all events, if it is true for me. Helmer, this is unheard of in a girl of your age. But if religion cannot lead you aright, let me try and waken your conscience. I suppose you have some moral sense, or answer me, am I to think you have none? Nora, I assure you, Torvald, that is not an easy question to answer. I really don't know. The thing perplexes me altogether. I only know that you and I look at it in quite a different light. I am learning, too, that the law is quite another thing from what I supposed, but I find it impossible to convince myself that the law is right. According to it, a woman has no right to spare her old dying father or to save her husband's life. I can't believe that. Helmer, you talk like a child. You don't understand the conditions of the world in which you live. Nora, no, I don't. But now I am going to try. I am going to see if I can make out who is right, the world or I. Helmer, you are ill, Nora. You are delirious. I almost think you are out of your mind. Nora, I have never felt my mind so clear and certain as tonight. Helmer, and is it with a clear and certain mind that you forsake your husband and your children? Nora, yes, it is. Helmer, then there is only one possible explanation. Nora, what is that? Helmer, you do not love me anymore. Nora, no, that's just it. Helmer, Nora, and you can say that? Nora, it gives me great pain, Torvald, for you have always been so kind to me, but I cannot help it. I do not love you anymore. Helmer, regaining his composure, is that a clear and certain conviction too? Nora, yes, absolutely clear and certain. That's the reason why I will not stay here any longer. Helmer, and can you tell me what I have done to forfeit your love? Nora, yes, indeed I can. It was tonight when the wonderful thing did not happen. Then I saw you were not the man I had thought you. Helmer, explain yourself better. I don't understand you. Nora, I have waited so patiently for 8 years, for goodness knows. I knew very well that wonderful things don't happen every day. Then this horrible misfortune came upon me, and then I felt quite certain that the wonderful thing was going to happen at last. When Krogstad's letter was lying out there, never for a moment did I imagine that you would consent to accept this man's conditions. I was so absolutely certain that you would say to him, publish the thing to the whole world. And when that was done, Helmer, yes, what then? When I had exposed my wife to shame and disgrace. Nora, when that was done, I was so absolutely certain you would come forward and take everything upon yourself and say, I am the guilty one. Helmer, Nora! Nora, you mean that I would never have accepted such a sacrifice on your part? No, of course not. But what would my assurances have been worth against yours? That's the wonderful thing which I hoped for and feared, and it was to prevent that I wanted to kill myself. Helmer, I would gladly work night and day for you, Nora, bear sorrow and want for your sake. But no one would sacrifice his honor for the one he loves. Nora, it is a thing hundreds of thousands of women have done. Helmer, oh, you think and talk like a heedless child. Nora, maybe, but you neither think nor talk like the man I could bind myself to. As soon as your fear was over, and it was not fear for what threatened me, but for what might happen to you, when the whole thing was past, as far as you were concerned, it was exactly as if nothing at all had happened. Exactly as before, I was your little skylark, your doll, which you would in future treat with doubly gentle care, because it was so brittle and fragile. Getting up, Torvald, it was then it dawned upon me that for 8 years I had been living here with a strange man and had borne him 3 children. Oh, I can't bear to think of it. I could tear myself into little bits. Helmer, sadly, I see, an abyss has opened between us. There's no denying it. But Nora, would it not be possible to fill it up? Nora, as I am now, I am no wife for you. Helmer, I have it in me to become a different man. Nora, perhaps, if your doll is taken away from you. Helmer, but to part from you, no, Nora, I can't understand that idea. Nora, going out to the right, that makes it all the more certain that it must be done. She comes back with her cloak and hat and a small bag, which she puts on a chair by the table. Helmer, Nora, not now. Wait till tomorrow. Nora, putting on her cloak, I cannot spend the night in a strange man's room. Helmer, but can't we live here like brother and sister? Nora, putting on her hat, you know very well that would not last long. Puts the shawl around her. Goodbye, Torvald. I won't see the little ones. I know they are in better hands than mine. As I am now, I can be of no use to them. Helmer, but someday, Nora, someday? Nora, how can I tell? I have no idea what's going to become of me. Helmer, but you are my wife. Whatever becomes of you? Nora, listen, Torvald. I have heard that when a wife deserts her husband's house, as I am doing now, he is legally freed from all obligations toward her. In any case, I set you free from all your obligations. You are not to feel yourself bound in the slightest way any more than I shall. There must be perfect freedom on both sides. See, here is your ring back. Give me mine. Helmer, that too? Nora, that too. Helmer, here it is. Nora, that's right. Now it's all over. I have put the keys here. The maids know all about everything in the house, better than I do. Tomorrow, after I have left her, Christine will come here and pack up my own things that I brought with me from home. I will have them sent after me. Helmer, all over? All over? Nora, shall you never think of me again? Nora, I know I shall often think of you and the children and the house. Helmer, may I write to you, Nora? Nora, no, never. You must not do that. Helmer, but at least let me send you... Nora, nothing. Helmer, let me help you if you are in want. Nora, no, I can receive nothing from a stranger. Helmer, Nora, can I never be anything more than stranger to you? Nora, taking her bag, ah, Torvald, the most wonderful thing of all would have to happen. Helmer, tell me what that would be. Nora, both you and I would have to be so changed that... Oh, Torvald, I don't believe any longer in wonderful things happening. Helmer, but I will believe in it. Tell me, so changed that... Nora, that our life together would be a real wedlock. Goodbye. She goes out through the hall. Helmer sinks down on a chair at the door and buries his face in his hands. Nora! Nora! Looks round and rises. Empty. She's gone. A hope flashes across his mind. The most wonderful thing of all? The sound of a door shutting is heard from below. Curtain. Now reread the jumping conflict once more. It's worthwhile to see how the elimination of transition can turn a rising conflict into a jumping one. Rising. Rising conflict is the result of a clear-cut premise and a well-orchestrated three-dimensional characters among whom unity is strongly established. Inflated egotism destroys itself is the premise of Ibsen's Hedda Gabler. In the end, Hedda kills herself because unwittingly she was caught in the web of her own making. As the play opens, Tessman and Hedda, his wife, have returned from their honeymoon the preceding night. Miss Tessman, the aunt with whom he had lived, arrives early in the morning to see if everything's all right. She and her bedridden sister have mortgaged their small annuity to secure a house for the newlyweds. She thinks of Tessman as her son, and he feels that she is both father and mother to him. Tessman, why, what a gorgeous bonnet you've been investing in. The bonnet is in his hand. He looks at it from all sides. Miss T, I bought it on Hedda's account. Tessman, on Hedda's account, eh? Miss T, yes, so that Hedda needn't be ashamed of me if we happen to go out together. Tessman puts down the bonnet and Hedda at last enters. She's irritable. Miss Tessman gives a package to Tessman. Tessman, well, I declare, have you really saved them for me, Aunt Julia? Hedda, isn't this touching? Hedda, well, what is it? Tessman, my old morning shoes, my slippers. Hedda, indeed. I remember you often spoke of them while we were abroad. Tessman, yes, I miss them terribly, goes up to her. Now you shall see them, Hedda. Hedda, going toward the stove, thanks, I really don't care about it. Tessman, following her, only think! Ill as she was, Aunt Rena embroidered these for me. Oh, you can't think of how many associations cling to them. Hedda at the table. Scarcely for me. Miss T, of course not for Hedda, George. Tessman, well, but now that she belongs to the family, I thought... Hedda, interrupting, we shall never get on with this servant, Tessman. The servant has practically mothered Tessman. Miss T, not get on with Bertha? Tessman, why, dear, what puts that in your head, eh? Hedda, pointing, look there! She has left her bonnet lying about on a chair. Tessman, in consternation, drops the slippers on the floor. Why, Hedda! Hedda, just fancy, if anyone should come in and see it. Tessman, but Hedda, that's Aunt Julia's bonnet. Hedda, is it? Miss T, taking up the bonnet, yes, indeed, it's mine. And what's more, it's not old, Madame Hedda. Hedda, I really did not look closely at it, Miss Tessman. Miss T, tying on the bonnet, let me tell you, it's the first time I have worn it, the very first time. Tessman, and a very nice bonnet it is, too, quite a beauty. Miss T, oh, it's no such great thing, George, looks around her. My parasol? Oh, here, takes it, for this is mine, too, mutters, not Bertha's. Tessman, a new bonnet and new parasol? Only think, Hedda. Hedda, very handsome indeed. Tessman, yes, isn't it, eh? But, Auntie, take a good look at Hedda before you go. See how handsome she is. Miss T, oh, my dear boy, there's nothing new in that. Hedda was always lovely. She moves away. Tessman, following, yes, but have you noticed what splendid condition she's in? How she is filled out on the journey? Hedda, crossing room, oh, do be quiet. Only a few pages at the very beginning of the play, and three full rounded characters stand before us. We know them, they breathe and live, whereas in Idiot's Delight, the author needs 2.5 acts to bring his two main characters together to defy a hostile world in the closing scene of the play. Why does the conflict rise in Hedda Gabler? First of all, there's unity of opposites. Then the characters are well-rounded persons with strong convictions. Hedda despises Tessman and everything he stands for. She's unrelenting. She married him for convenience and uses him to attain a higher place in society. Can she corrupt him, the soul of purity and scrupulous honesty? No playwright can line up such people, all of them so utterly different, without a well-defined premise. Tension can be achieved through uncompromising characters in a death struggle. The premise should show the goal, and the characters should be driven to this goal, as fate did in the Greek drama. In Tartuffe, the rising conflict is attributable to Orgon, the pivotal character who forces the conflict. He's uncompromising. To start with, he declares, "He, Tartuffe, detached my soul from these and taught me to set my heart on nothing that is here below. And now, were I to see my mother, wife, or children die, I should do so without so much as a pang." Any man who can make such statements will create conflict, and he does. As Helmer's belief in scrupulous honesty and civic pride precipitated his drama, Orgon's rabid intolerance brought on himself all the mishaps that befell him. We want to emphasize the rabid intolerance. Iago in Othello is relentless. Hamlet's bulldog tenacity drives him on to the bitter end. Oedipus's deep-rooted desire to find the murderer of the king brought tragedy upon himself. Such iron-willed characters, driven by a well-understood and clearly defined premise, cannot help but lift the play to the highest pitch. Two determined, uncompromising forces in combat will create a viral rising conflict. Don't let anyone tell you that only certain types of conflict possess dramatic or theatrical value. Any type will do if you have tri-dimensional characters with a clear-cut premise. Through conflict, these characters will reveal themselves, assume dramatic value, suspense, and all the other attributes which theatrical jargon terms dramatic. In Ghosts, Mander's opposition to Mrs. Alving is gentle at first, but it slowly develops into a rising conflict. Manders, ah, there we have the outcome of your reading. Fine fruit it has borne, this abominable, subversive, free-thinking literature. Poor Manders, how righteous he is in his condemnation. He feels that he has uttered the last word, and Mrs. Alving will be crushed. His attack was condemnation. Now we have the counterattack constituting conflict. The condemnation alone could not grow into conflict if the person condemned accepted it. But Mrs. Alving rejects it, hurls it back in his face. Mrs. Alving, you are wrong there, my friend. You are the one who made me begin to think, and I owe you my best thanks for it. No wonder Manders cries out in consternation. 2. The counterattack must be stronger than the attack in order that the conflict may not be static. Mrs. Alving therefore acknowledges the deed but puts the blame on her accuser. Mrs. Alving, yes, by forcing me to submit to what you call my duty and my obligations, by praising as right and just what my whole soul revolted against as it would against something abominable, that was what led me to examine your teachings critically. I only wanted to unravel one point in them, but as soon as I had got them unraveled, the whole fabric came to pieces, and then I realized that it was only machine-made. She forces him into a defensive position. He staggered for a moment. Attack, counterattack. Manders, softly and with emotion. Is that all that I accomplished by the hardest struggle of my life? Mrs. Alving offered herself to him at a critical moment. He's reminding her of his sacrifice in refusing her. This soft question is a challenge, and Mrs. Alving meets it. Mrs. Alving, call it rather the most ignominious defeat of your life. Every word carries the conflict further. If I call someone a thief, it's an invitation to conflict, but nothing more. Just as the male is needed with the female for conception, so something is needed with the challenge for a conflict. The accused might answer, "Look who's talking," and refuse to take offense, thus creating an abortion so far as conflict is concerned. But if he calls you a thief in retaliation, there's the promise of a conflict. The drama is not the image of life, but the essence. We must condense. In life, people quarrel year in, year out, without once deciding to remove the factor which causes the trouble. In drama, this must be condensed to the essentials, giving the illusion of years of bickering without the superfluous dialogue. It's interesting to note that rising conflict was achieved in Tartuffe by a method different from that in A Doll's House. Whereas in Ibsen's plays, conflict means actual combat between characters, in Tartuffe, Molière starts with group lined up against group. Orgon's insistence to be ruined by himself cannot be considered conflict. Nevertheless, it achieves rising tension. Let us watch him. Orgon, it is a deed of gift drawn up with all formality by which I make over my whole estate to you. This statement is certainly not an attack. Tartuffe, recoiling, to me? Oh, brother, brother, how came you to think this? And this is not a counterattack either. Orgon, why, to tell you the truth, it was your story that put it into my head. Tartuffe, my story? Orgon, yes, about your friend at Lyons. I mean, Limoges. Surely you have not forgotten that. Tartuffe, it comes back to me now, but had I thought it would prompt you to this, brother, I would have cut out my tongue ere I had told you. Orgon, but you don't. You can't mean that you refuse. Tartuffe, nay, how can I accept so heavy a responsibility? Orgon, why not? The other man did. Tartuffe, ah, brother, but he was a saint, whereas I am but an unworthy vessel. Orgon, I know none saintlier, none I would trust more entirely than you. Tartuffe, were I to accept this trust, men of Belial would say that I had taken a base advantage of your simplicity. Orgon, men know me better than that, my friend. I am not one who can be easily duped. Tartuffe, not what they may say of me, brother, but of you. Orgon, then dismiss your fear, my friend, for it is my delight to set them gabbling. And think of the power for good that deed would give you. By it you could reform my unruly household, rid it altogether of the laxity and profusion that have so long vexed your tender soul. Tartuffe, it would indeed give me great opportunities. Orgon, ah, you admit that. Then is it not your duty to accept, for their sakes and mine? Tartuffe, I had not looked on it in that light before. It may be even as you say. Orgon, it is so. Brother, their salvation is in your hands. Can you leave them to perish utterly? Tartuffe, your arguments have overcome me, dear friend. I did wrong to hesitate. Orgon, then you accept the trust. Tartuffe, the will of heaven be done in this as in all other things. I accept. He puts the deed in his breast. There is no conflict so far, but we know that not only Orgon, the dupe, will be ruined by this deed, but his lovable and decent family also. We'll watch with bated breath how Tartuffe will use this newly acquired power. This scene really is a preparation for conflict, foreshadowing conflict. We're confronted here with a different rising conflict than we have heretofore expounded. Which approach is better? The answer is, either is good if it helps the conflict to rise. Molière achieved his rising conflict by welding the family together to defeat Tartuffe, group against group. Tartuffe's reluctance to accept Orgon's offer is hypocritical and weak. It's really no conflict at all. But the very offer of Orgon to transfer his fortune to Tartuffe constitutes the tension and foreshadows a death struggle between him and the family. Come back to ghosts for a moment. Mander says, ah, there we have the outcome of your reading. Fine fruit it has borne, this abominable, subversive, free-thinking literature. If Mrs. Alving answered, really, or what affair is it of yours, or what do you know about books, or anything of the kind which would rebuke Manders without attacking him, the conflict would at once be static. But she answers, you are wrong there, my friend. She gives a general denial, first adding irony with my friend. The next sentence is a bombshell carrying the attack to enemy territory. It's a body blow, almost paralyzing. You're the one who made me begin to think, and I owe you my best thanks for it. Manders, too, is equivalent to ouch in the ring, or even foul. Mrs. Alving follows up her advantage, showering blows on the unfortunate Manders, winding up with an uppercut which just misses its mark. If Mrs. Alving had succeeded in annihilating her antagonist, the play would have been over. But Manders is not a mean fighter, either. When he's staggered, he spars to get his wind back, and then counterattacks fiercely. This is rising conflict. Mrs. Alving, call it rather the most ignominious defeat of your life. The blow that glanced off Manders' chin. Manders, sparring, it was the greatest victory of my life, Helen. Victory over myself. Mrs. Alving, tired but game, it was a wrong done to both of us. Manders, seeing an opening, rushes in. A wrong? Wrong for me to entreat you as a wife to go back to your lawful husband when you came to me, half distracted, and cried, here I am, take me? Was that wrong? The conflict is still going higher and higher, revealing the character's inmost feelings, the forces that made them act as they did, the position in which they now stand, the direction in which they're going. Each character has a well-defined premise in life. They know what they want and fight for it. Eugene O'Neill's Morning Becomes Electra is a splendid example of rising conflict. The only trouble is that the characters, although involved in a death struggle, are not deeply motivated. If you read the synopsis at the end of this book, you'll find a dynamic, irresistible force driving the characters toward their inevitable end. Lavinia to revenge her father and Christine to free herself from her husband's bondage. Conflict comes in waves, rising higher and higher to an awesome crescendo, overwhelming in its power until we start to scrutinize the characters. Then, to our sorrow, we realize that all this blood and thunder was just sham. We can't believe them. They weren't living people. They were the creation of an author who has extraordinary vitality and power to make them behave as conscious living beings should. But the moment he leaves them alone, they collapse from the sheer weight of their existence. The characters go relentlessly where the author tells them to go. They have no will of their own. Lavinia hates her mother with a cold hate because that will create conflict. She finds out things about her father which would mitigate her fierce, protective love for him, but she dismisses it as something non-existent. She had to if she was to go through with the part the author assigned to her. Captain Brent hates the Mannons because they let his mother starve to death, but that he left her himself for years, abandoning her to her fate, is not important either. The conflict has to go on. Christine hates her husband because her love turned to hate, and she kills him. But what made this love turn to hate? The author never explains. O'Neill has a good reason not to divulge his secret. He doesn't know himself. He has no premise. He imitated the Greek pattern. He thought if he substituted fate instead of premise, he would secure a driving force which would match the classics of the Hellenic drama. He failed because the Greek dramas have premise under the disguise of fate, whereas O'Neill has blind fate only without a premise. As we see, rising conflict can be achieved with superficial, badly motivated characters also, but this is not the play we're after. Such plays may impress us, even terrorize us, while we are in the theater. But such plays soon become only a memory because they bear no resemblance to life as we know it. The characters are not three-dimensional. Once more, then, rising conflict means a clear-cut premise and unity of opposites with three-dimensional characters. 6. Movement. It's simple enough to recognize a storm as a conflict, yet what we experience and call storm or tornado is actually a climax, the result of hundreds and thousands of small conflicts, each bigger and more dangerous than the last, until they arrive at the crisis, the lull before the storm. In that last moment, the decision is made, and the storm either moves on or breaks in all its fury. When we think of any manifestation of nature, we're likely to think of it as having only one possible cause. We say that a storm starts in such and such a way, forgetting that each storm has a different background, although the results are essentially the same, just as each death arises from different conditions, although in essence, death is death. Every conflict consists of attack and counterattack, yet every conflict differs from every other conflict. There are small, almost imperceptible movements in every conflict, transitions, which determine the type of rising conflict you'll employ. These transitions, in their turn, are determined by the individual characters. If a character is a slow thinker or sluggish, his transition will affect the conflict by its resultant sluggishness. And since no two individuals ever think exactly alike, no two transitions and no two conflicts will ever be identical. Let us watch Nora and Helmer for a while. Let us see the motivation that they themselves do not know. Why does Nora assent when that clinches Helmer's argument against her? What goes into a simple sentence? Helmer has just found out about the forgery. He's in a rage. Helmer, miserable creature, what have you done? This is not an attack. He knows quite well what she's done, but is too horrified to believe it. He's struggling with himself and needs a breathing spell, but the line foreshadows a vicious attack to come. Nora, let me go. You shall not suffer for my sake. You shall not take it upon yourself. And this is not a counterattack. Yet the conflict continues to rise. She's not yet aware that Helmer has no intention of taking the blame upon himself, nor does she fully realize that he's angry with her. He is flared up, she knows, but he doesn't mean it. She retains that last shred of naivete, which makes her so appealing in the face of the onrushing danger. This is not a fighting sentence, then, but a transition which helps the conflict rise. If we didn't know Helmer, his character, his moral scruples, his fanatical honesty, Nora's struggle with Krogstad would not be conflict at all. There would be nothing to look forward to. The one question would be, who will outsmart whom? The small movement, then, becomes important only in its relation to the big movement. Hay Fever is a play which offers material for illustration. The scene we have taken from it contains no big movements. There's nothing at stake, nothing to make the little movements important. If one character loses out, there's no harm done. Tomorrow's another day. The fact that this is a comedy is no excuse for so serious a flaw, as proved by the further fact that this is not a good comedy. The parenthetical comments after each speech, attack, then counterattack, indicate that speech's potentialities for development into each conflict. From Hay Fever by Noel Coward. A family consisting of a charming mother who is a retired actress, a charming father who's a novelist, and two charming children who are just charming has invited guests for the weekend. Mother Judith has invited her latest, Father David has invited his latest, daughter Sorrel has invited her latest, and son Simon has invited guess who? They quarrel about sleeping arrangements until the guests arrive, four ordinary people who serve as stooges for the family. Sorrel. I should have thought you'd be above encouraging silly, shallow young men who are infatuated by your name. Attack. Judith, that may be true, but I shall allow no one but myself to say it. I hoped you'd grow up a good daughter to me, not a critical aunt. Counterattack. Rise. Sorrel, it's so terribly cheap. Attack. Judith, cheap? Nonsense. What about your diplomatist? Counterattack. Sorrel, surely that's a little different, dear. Judith, if you mean that because you happen to be a vigorous ingenue of 19, you have the complete monopoly of any amorous adventure there may be about, I feel it my firm duty to disillusion you. Attack. Sorrel, but mother. Judith, anyone would think I was 80 the way you go on. It was a great mistake not sending you to boarding schools, and you coming back in my being your elder sister. Static. Simon. It wouldn't have been any use. Everyone knows we're your son and daughter. Judith, only because I was stupid enough to dandle you about in front of cameras when you were little. I knew I should regret it. Static. Simon, I don't see any point in trying to be younger than you are. Attack. Rise. Judith, at your age, dear, it would be indecent if you did. Counterattack. Sorrel, but mother, dear, don't you see it's awfully undignified for you to go flaunting about with young men? Attack. Judith, I don't flaunt about. I never have. I've been morally an extremely nice woman all my life, more or less, and if dabbling gives me pleasure, I don't see why I shouldn't dabble. Static. Sorrel, but it oughtn't give you pleasure anymore. Attack. Judith, you know, Sorrel, you grow more damnably feminine every day. I wish I'd brought you up differently. Counterattack. Sorrel, I'm proud of being feminine. Attack. Judith, you're a darling, and I adore you, kissing her. And you're very pretty, and I'm madly jealous of you. Static. Sorrel, are you really? How lovely. Static. Judith, you will be nice to Sandy, won't you? Static. Sorrel, can't he sleep in little hell? Static. Judith, my dear, he's frightfully athletic, and all those water pipes will sap his vitality. Static. Sorrel, they'll sap Richard's vitality, too. Static. Judith, he won't notice them. He's probably used to scorching tropical embassies with punkas waving and everything. Static. Simon. He's sure to be deadly anyhow. Static. Sorrel. You're getting too blasé and exclusive, Simon. Jump. Simon. Nothing of the sort, only I loathe being hearty with your men friends. Attack. Sorrel. You've never been civil to any of my friends, men or women. Counterattack. Simon. Anyhow, the Japanese room's a woman's room, and a woman ought to have it. Static, even for the transition it's intended to be. Judith, I promised it to Sandy. He loves everything Japanese. Static. Simon, so does Myra. Jump. Judith, Myra. Rise. Simon, Myra Arendelle, I've asked her down. Rise. Judith, you've what? Rise. Surprise, surprise, nobody but the audience suspected that Simon might have invited someone too. This is the point which was reached by the scene, a clear waste of several pages because there's no big movement to give meaning to the small movements. There's not much transition either due to the transparency and two-dimensionality of the characters. You wish to start an automobile. This is your premise. First, you ignite the gas. A drop of gasoline will explode. If for any reason there's no further explosion, conflict, the car will remain static, as will your play. but if the gasoline flows freely, one explosion will set off another explosion, conflict creates conflict, and the engine will vibrate with a steady hum. The car and your play is moving. The many small explosions will move the car ahead. Not one or two, but many explosions are necessary to start the big movement of the wheels. In a play, each conflict causes the one after it. Each is more intense than the one before. The play moves, propelled by the conflict created by the characters in their desire to reach their goal, the proof of the premise. But let's go back to our old friends Nora and Helmer. Let's see how their conflict moves and changes. Helmer, no tragedy airs, please, locks the hall door. Here you shall stay and give me an explanation. Do you understand what you've done? Answer me. Do you understand what you have done? The lines suggest the increasing tempo. The locking of the door adds weight to his words. The whole speech is an attack. Nora looks steadily at him and says with a growing look of coldness in her face, "Yes, now I am beginning to understand thoroughly." Nora's answer is not a counterattack. True, attack and counterattack is the most direct, the shortest method of building a conflict, but it cannot be employed exclusively throughout a play without becoming tiresome and without ending the play far too rapidly. Nora's answer is negative, but we must understand why. She's refusing to obey her lord's impatient demand for an explanation. She explains nothing, but there's the first ray of awakening in her answer, the first sign that Helmer will receive more than he bargained for. Is Nora's line a fighting one then? Definitely. The coldness, the tone, give warning of danger ahead. But Helmer, in his fury, doesn't see it. Step by step, he drives himself into an uncontrollable rage. Helmer, walking about the room. What a horrible awakening, all these 8 years. See, who was my joy and pride? A hypocrite, a liar, worse, a criminal. The unutterable ugliness of it all. For shame, for shame. Nora is silent and looks steadily at him. He stops in front of her. Helmer's attack is now so vicious that any interruption on Nora's part would kill the effect Ibsen has achieved. Her silence is sufficiently eloquent and speaks for her better than any line even a Shakespeare might conceive. We see then that the conflict becomes a variation on the straight attack-counterattack. Nora's silence is a subtle counterattack in that it's resistance in preparation for action. Helmer, I ought to have suspected that something of the sort would happen. I ought to have foreseen it. All your father's want of principle. Be silent. All your father's want of principle has come out in you. No religion, no morality, no sense of duty. Now I am punished for having winked at what he did. I did it for your sake, and this is how you repay me? Helmer's attack is direct, overwhelming. Nora's answer is interesting. Nora, yes, that's just it. Her agreement proves his point, but there's a reason. She wishes to leave. She sees for the first time that the past 8 years have been a bad dream. Her answer is negative again, not an orthodox counterattack, but the first sign of an awakening resistance. Moreover, it serves to infuriate Helmer. The man who wishes to fight and finds no opponent becomes increasingly dangerous. We do not wish to imply that Nora's intention is to anger her husband. On the contrary, she sees now the hopelessness of life with him. She agrees because she's strengthened in her determination to leave, and because what he says is true, but only now does she see the implications of the truth. Ibsen uses her state to further the conflict. As we read on, we see how Helmer, with overpowering arguments, tramples Nora down. The battle seems one-sided, seems like a prize fight in which one fighter showers blows on an apparently defenseless opponent. But Nora, instead of weakening, is waiting her turn patiently. Every blow strengthens her position, and her resistance is a counterattack in itself. This type of conflict differs from that which we discussed earlier. It's different, but no less effective. Question. It is effective, all right, but I see no difference. Answer. Do you remember the scene we quoted from Ghosts? The scene between Manders and Mrs. Alving contained all the elements of direct conflict. The entire play was written on that line, attack, counterattack, with few exceptions. Yet we cannot make a flat statement to the effect that all superior plays should be built on that principle because it was successful in Ghosts. Question, why not? Answer, because the situation and the characters are not the same. every conflict must be treated with regard to the characters and the situation involved. Ghosts starts at a high pitch. Mrs. Alving is a bitter person, worldly wise, disillusioned. She's exactly the opposite of the gullible, spoiled, childlike Nora. These characters will certainly generate different kinds of conflict. Mrs. Alving's conflict comes at the beginning of the play and arises from her patience, her efforts to keep up appearances. Nora's big conflict comes at the end of the play and arises from her ignorance of money matters. Certainly, they require different treatment. But although the type of conflict varies with the characters, there must be conflict throughout.